So you want to get a degree. Why? Let me tell you what society will tell you. It increases your chances of getting a job, provides you with an opportunity to be successful. Your life will be a lot less stressful. Education is the key. Now let me tell you what your parents will tell you. Make me proud. Increases your chances of getting a job, provides you with an opportunity to be successful. Your life will be a lot less stressful. Education is the key. Now let's look at the statistics. Steve Jobs, net worth, $7 billion, RIP. Richard Branson, net worth, $4.2 billion. Oprah Winfrey, net worth, $2.7 billion. Mark Zuckerberg, Henry Ford, Steven Spielberg, Bill Gates. Now here comes the coup de grace. Looking at these individuals, what's your conclusion? Neither of them, in being successful, ever graduated from a higher learning institution. Now some of you will protest, like, you know, money's only the medium by which one measures worldly success. And some of you even have the nerve to say, I don't do it for the money. So what are you studying for? To work for a charity? Need more clarity? Let's look at the statistics. Jesus, Muhammad, peace be upon him, Socrates, Malcolm X, Mother Teresa, Spielberg, Shakespeare, Beethoven, Jesse Owens, Muhammad Ali, Sean Carter, Michael Jeffrey Jordan, Michael Joseph Jackson, were either of these people unsuccessful or uneducated? All I'm saying is that if there was a family tree, hard work and education would be related, but school would probably be a distant cousin. As if education is the key, then school is the lock. Because it rarely ever develops your mind to the point where it can perceive red as green and continue to go when someone else says stop. Because as long as you follow the rules and pass the exams, you're cool. But are you aware that examiners have a checklist? And if your answer is something outside of the box, the automatic response is a cross. And then they claim that school expands your horizons and your visions. Well, tell that to Malcolm X, who dropped out of school and is well renowned for what he learned in a prison. Proverbs 17:16. It does a fool no good to spend money on an education. Why? Because he has no common sense. George Bush. Need I say more? Education is about inspiring one's mind, not just filling their head. And take this from me, because I'm an educated man myself, who only came to this realization after countless nights in the library, with a can of Red Bull keeping me awake till dawn and another can in the morn, falling asleep in between piles of books which probably equated to the same amount I had spent on my rent, memorize equations, facts and dates right down to the letter, half of which I'd never remember and half of which I'd forget straight after the exam and before the start of the next semester, asking anyone if they had notes for the last lecture. I often found myself running to class just so I could find a spot on which I could rest my head and fall asleep without making a scene. Ironic, because that's the only time I ever spent in university chasing my dreams. And then after nights with a dead mind, I'd then find myself in a queue of half-awake student zombies waiting to hand in an assignment. Maybe that's why they called it a deadline. And then after 3 years of mental suppression and frustration, my proud mother didn't even turn up to my graduation. Now, I'm not saying that school is evil and there's nothing to gain, but all I'm saying is understand your motives and reassess your aims, because if you want a job working for someone else, then help yourself. But then that would be a contradiction, because you wouldn't really be helping yourself, you'd be helping somebody else. There's a saying which says, if you don't build your dream, someone else will hire you to help build theirs. Redefine how you view education. Understand its true meaning. Education is not just about regurgitating facts from a book on someone else's opinion on a subject to pass an exam. Look at it. Picasso was educated in creating art. Shakespeare was educated in the art of all that was written. Colonel Harlan Sanders was educated in the art of creating Kentucky Fried Chicken. I once saw David Beckham take a free kick. I watched as the side of his Adidas-sponsored boot hit the patent leather of the ball at an angle which caused it to travel towards the skies as though it was destined for the heavens. And then as it reached the peak of its momentum, as though it changed its mind, it switched directions. I watched as the goalkeeper froze, as though reciting to himself the laws of physics, and as though his brain was negotiating with his eyes that it was indeed witnessing the spectacle of the leather swan that was swooping towards it, and then reacting. And before the net of the goal embraced the FIFA-sponsored ball as though it was the prodigal son returning home, and the country that I live in erupted into cheers, I looked at the play and thought, damn. Looking at David Beckham, there's more than one way in this world to be an educated man.
Hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today's December 4th. Audio you just heard was from a video that a number of people sent to me, either through email or Facebook, over the course of the last week, and it is called Why I Hate School But Love Education, Spoken Word, by Sula Breezy. And I'll put a link to that in the show notes. And while I might not be in total agreement with every sentiment in that video, I think the general idea is certainly something with which we can all identify. So I thought I would include it at the beginning of the show, not just for popular demand, but I think it also kind of gets us moving in the right direction, some of the things that I wanted to talk about on the show today. First of all, what you're ultimately going to hear is a segment from the live show we recorded last Thursday. I have left most of that show on the cutting room floor just because it really was kind of a misfire. We thought we were going to have an unschooler on the show, and the person that Osborne brought turned out not to be an unschooler. We had a good time. It just wasn't a very content-rich show, but it will be on YouTube within the next few days in its entirety. So you're only going to hear an edited portion of the show today, just stripped down to pretty much the most important stuff. The article that we talk about in the show was a reinforcement of some thoughts, some ideas that I was already having as a result of an experience that I recently had with a student. I got a new client, girl from UNH. She was a sophomore. She was studying genetics and I think biotech. And she was just under the most incredible amount of stress. 19 years old. And I'm like, I could see, you know, the stress physically in this young person. What she wanted help with was, she didn't say, she said, I'm not really having trouble grasping these concepts as they are delivered through whatever channels, lectures or the textbook, but I'm having a lot of trouble with retention. And there's these really crucial moments where I need to remember this stuff and how it kind of fits together, and I just can't. And I'm not an expert on biotech or genetics, but I do try to offer people some strategies for how to, improve organization, motivation, and maybe even retention. And usually what I've found with high school students is that if they're not remembering things, the truth is it's probably because they're not interested in it. But here, she is very interested in this. She was very career-oriented, very, very stressed out about how her higher education experience was going so far. So I needed to do like this initial consultation session to, you know, just build a rapport, but also maybe give her some quick strategies that could put out the fires that were already burning. And, I started talking to her about her learning style and what were her expectations for how she wants to get the content, the information that she needs to know to do well in this endeavor and ultimately the vocation that she needs this whole education for. And she said that her expectations were that she would get most of the material from the textbook or from lectures. Yeah, I mean, that's pretty typical in college. You're in a lecture hall with 300 people. Maybe you've never even had a face-to-face conversation with your teacher. And, the truth is they might not even be a very good teacher. These science teachers, I know I've talked about this before, good at science, not always so good at teaching. And, you know, that's not a rule, but it's something that I've found to be pretty common, at least at the secondary school level. So, you know, she said she was a very experiential learner. She learned by doing. And I said, well, you know, if you're a science major, don't you have like labs where there's some reinforcement for the stuff in the textbook or in the lectures? She says, yeah, we have a lab, but it's unrelated to what we're doing in the class or for, you know, out of class work. And I was like, well, you know, what the F? That doesn't make any sense at all. It's like just giving somebody extra work to do, right? And she said one of the things that had been most helpful to her was she was working with like a research assistant as the research assistant's assistant, like basically an internship in school. And she said she found that hands-on experience, that doing, learning by living, essentially, even though it's a job, and some jobs can be that. I mean, living is moving around with a purpose, you know? And if you like your job, you can do that. It's certainly way divorced from what school is, where you're just sitting there like a piece of flypaper. Maybe not all the time, but a lot of the time, certainly in these college lectures. So anyway, she found this experience, this work experience, to be very, very helpful, but wasn't always aligned with what she was doing in school. So I asked her, I said, you know, you've been in high school for 4 years. She went to actually the same high school. Then she had been at UNH for about, you know, a year and almost a semester by the time we met. I said, have you ever contemplated really like how well does your learning style line up with the teaching styles that you so often encounter in secondary school and in college, which a lot of the time are pretty much the same? And she said, no, I've never even thought about that. That's never even occurred to me. And I said, okay, well, that's one important thing, because what you probably have to do is stop relying, if you really want to learn this stuff, we probably have to kind of like shift more towards a focus on your intrinsic motivation, right? Like you have a desire to learn this because this is useful, because you're not going after grades, you're not going after the national dean's list or whatever. You're not just trying to get a degree so you can, you know, use it as a ticket to get into job interviews after you graduate, as you kind of just, you know, fumble your way through a major that you haphazardly chose when you were 16 because you were told that you had to choose a major. She's like focused on this certain career, and she's trying to attain the knowledge that she needs to be able to do that career someday. So it didn't seem like motivation was a problem, but I said, you know, you have to, I think this, what's needed here is for you to develop strategies that work regardless of how well the textbook works for you, or regardless of how unaccommodating a university professor might be to you. And she understood that. And I said, you know, if you're an experiential learner, what we could do together, because I'm not an expert on what you're learning, is you could teach it to me. And I talked about the cone of learning, which is a diagram that I've used like in show notes and for episode images before, where it talks about how retention works for different ways of learning, typically. And obviously, this is a little bit adjustable. But when something is delivered to you in a lecture, when you're just sitting there and listening to something that you might not be too interested in, especially when it's something that's considerably complex, you might remember from a lecture, even really if you're taking notes, 5 to 10% of it. And maybe, you know, reading is a little bit more, maybe reading gets up to 20. And then it goes into like hearing something, like maybe listening to a podcast versus hearing and seeing something. And then we're going up in the percentage of information that is retained as we get into hearing and seeing, and then maybe talking about something. Maybe now we're like up over 50% retention. But I said to her, the most effective way to remember what you learn is to explain it to somebody else, to teach it. It's pretty much how I learned just about everything I know about history. I mean, I had this idea after graduating from college that I was excited about history, that it was something that I was interested in talking about and sharing with other people. And I remembered like some, like the highlights and a general timeline. But as far as the retention of all the information that I had received, it was very, very little. And fortunately, I did have notes, and through, I hate to say it, repetition, and through, you know, explaining it to other people, a lot of that information became more concrete for me. But as I got out of practice, you know, when I went back, we did that Thanksgiving show a couple weeks ago, I went back and I looked at it again. And a lot of it started to come back, and I realized, wow, I can't believe how much of this became unrecallable, you know, just from not having taught it in so long. So I won't call it repetition, but there is like a certain level of maintenance, I think. Now, there are some ideas that are just so clear and so powerful, and some stories that also, you know, fit that description that you could just never forget. But I was just like, all of these details, having that more complete picture, yes, I think that requires some maintenance, which I hadn't been doing. But the best maintenance was to teach it. So I'm not going to bore you with like some of the strategies for note-taking that we talked about, but she walked away, I felt, after 90 minutes of just a preliminary session, feeling much better. And like I said, I could see the stress that she felt. It was like, it was all over her face. It was in her body language. But she seemed relieved. And the person who referred me to her contacted me and said, yeah, I heard from so-and-so. They said it went well and they're optimistic. And I felt really good about it. Like, hey, here I am. I'm your ally in this situation that is so frustrating. And we can get through this and we can get something meaningful out of it. And you shouldn't feel like there's anything wrong with you for struggling through incredibly complex information that might not be being delivered in the best fashion for your learning style, in the best fashion for you to retain the optimal amount of information. So I felt like, yes, we're doing good work here. And like 4 days later, I got an email saying that she withdrew from school. I didn't want to pry. That sounds like a personal thing. So I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing. Did she realize that, yeah, this environment is just not going to work for me? The price that I'm paying in stress is just too high. I can't go on. I should do something else. Or did she kind of withdraw with this sense of failure? So it was very, very frustrating because, like I said, I really, really felt good. When I got up at the end of that session, we were just in the, you know, the library cafe at UNH, and I got up and walked away and I was like, I'm good at what I do. That went well, you know, I felt great. So that kind of really just deflated that excitement a few days later. And it got me thinking, I've had a lot of these experiences, this sense of really swimming upstream in this business. And the enthusiasm and maybe the passion and the energy that I've tried to put into it, you know, it's not always there, but like some days I've just walked away feeling so good about this, but then something would happen that would like bring me back to reality. Like you are a tiny, tiny, tiny little force fighting a very, very powerful problem that gains more power as people fail to recognize what a problem it is. And the university system, like what she was telling me about her class experiences, really just taking advantage of the docility that students learn in high school, where the teaching style is the teaching style. And if you do not do well in this class, as we measure with one of these five letters, something is wrong with you. And I tried to go through the high school stuff with her, and she totally understood it. She totally identified with it. And it also seemed like it was, for her, like somewhat revelatory. Like, I've never even thought about that before. And I felt like the conversation that we had and the information that I provided had given her some sense of relief. So I was disappointed to hear, I was sad to hear that she left school, but, you know, I don't really know why, but most of the thinking that I did was like, maybe I'm putting a little bit too much into this, and maybe I really should think about doing something else. Like maybe that time that I'm trying to spend tutoring should just go into the podcast. And maybe I should do something else. Maybe I should compartmentalize, right? Maybe I should just do some kind of job that I can do that makes money. There's, you know, plenty of choices out there. I'm sure I have a good resume, and I'm sure there's options, and I've already looked at a few options, you know, cultivated through some connections that I have. But yeah, maybe I just shouldn't do the tutoring stuff anymore. Because what I've realized is that very, very few of the opportunities that I've had since leaving teaching in 2006 have been outside of the role of being a reinforcer in some way for the system that already exists. I think that in a lot of respects, the SAT is that. And, you know, maybe, yeah, I understand the realities. Like, the SAT is kind of a mandatory thing for college. It was a great job that we did as a company to try and find some opportunities within preparing for that test to help people improve valuable skills that are, you know, there for later in life. The writing skills, the making persuasive arguments, building vocabulary, logical reasoning. That's all good stuff. I'm proud of that. I think that's great. But I have 10 hours to deliver all that stuff to a varying range of interest levels in what I have to say. 10 hours to try and undo or even fight against thousands of hours of government indoctrination. And I think I'm done with that. Also, over the course of the last week, this story was brought to my attention.
Good evening. Welcome to the Pearl Report. I'm Diana Lin. More than half of Hong Kong's secondary school pupils pay for tutors privately or in crammed centres, principally to help them pass exams. This is costing parents hundreds of millions of dollars each year. Producer Sebastian Chow looks at the culture of celebrity surrounding some tutors.
Richard Eng is a tutor, but he's not your typical tutor. He drives a Lamborghini, owns a multi-million dollar home, and makes annual shopping trips to Paris.
Check it out.
Eng has come a long way from his humble roots as a government school teacher.
I found that there were a lot of restrictions when I taught, especially the fact that I had to stick to a grammar book or a textbook. So I thought that why don't I start my own business?
In 1990, he opened his first tutorial school in Yuen Long.
I found that students in Yuen Long, they didn't have a tutorial school, and I knew that they could not go out to the urban area to take up tutorial lessons so easily. So I started up everything there. I remember there were only three classrooms accommodating less than maybe 100 students. In 1993, we found that actually the demand was really very great. Our expansion was mainly at the beginning in the new territories, Sha Tin and Shanxi and Yuen Long and then Tin Wen. That's the first step of our finding ourselves in a very successful place.
The next step was publicizing his business.
At the very beginning, there was no advertising strategy because of our limited capital.
A moment of inspiration changed that.
My sister is an artist. Sometimes she appeared in magazines, and when she was with me and my mother, sometimes I would appear in magazines too. And then I had an idea that if this is the case, then why don't I do it myself? So I tried this, and then some market followers came in. And then in 2003, there was a very, very big change. I would say it's a turning point. I found that nobody advertised on a moving object like a bus. So I printed myself on the back of the bus, and it was really our kind of wow at the time. Okay, a lot of people were talking about this, so we have, at that time, created a kind of market noise. Today, it is a trend for a tutor to appear around a bus or even a minibus. Even today, I know that advertising is very important. If you teach very well, but nobody knows it, then it is a waste.
Richard now runs 13 tutorial centers catering to 25,000 students. He personally teaches 3,000 students and takes home more than $1.5 million a year. Overall, the tutoring industry in Hong Kong is worth more than $400 million a year, and tutors have become celebrities.
Star tutors can be found elsewhere, in Korea, for example, in Taiwan, but it's a phenomenon which seems to be more obvious in Hong Kong. And particularly the way that it is personalized to be a star tutor, to be like a film star or a pop star in the music industry. Society, the magazines, the messages all over the place do emphasize education, do emphasize the need to give young people all the chances they can get.
When you have a test-based culture, it's inevitable. And what the tutors are doing are focusing on passing the test.
And the image is that the tutors, particularly the big commercial companies, will give tips, will give exam-dominated training, will give the students things that they feel that they cannot get in the school system.
I know that students love shortcuts, and then they want to get the highest mark with the least amount of effort.
Before you answer the questions, you really need to skim it first, and then you really need to make a prediction.
25-year-old Kelly Mock works for one of Richard's rival education centers. After 2 years as an English tutor, Kelly is drawing about 1,000 students to her classes and earns a monthly wage in the high five figures. She says most schools neglect the teaching of exam skills. That's why tutors like her are so popular.
Well, not that they don't teach exams, but, you know, they teach everything on the syllabus, but they don't focus on how to score A. I mean, like, they teach everything, but they don't tell you that is what you need because that is going to be on the exam. There's one that I asked my class, do you guys know what a paragraph is? What is a topic sentence or a supporting sentence? They told me they have no idea what these things are. I was shocked because I would expect them to have learned that from school.
Like most of the commercial education centers, Kelly's school focuses almost exclusively on passing exams.
Now, this was first brought to my attention on the School Sucks Facebook page by a listener named Alan. So thank you, Alan. When I was watching this and reading the article that he originally had sent, I realized that outside of the stuff that I've done with homeschoolers, this kind of tutoring is basically all that anyone has ever asked me to do. Hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome to School Sucks Live. Tonight on the show, the list of world's sexiest Asian tutors is out. Did I make it, you ask? No.
Because you're not Asian?
Beauty today.
I'm sorry.
The standards. Who can live up to them? So in the studio with me tonight, we have our old friend and co-host. Can I call you doctor? Just this once, Dr.
Sure.
Jason Osborne.
Go ahead.
Osborne is a doctor. He has a PhD in economics. Sitting next to him is his friend who he brought. And actually, Andrew, you work for Osborne.
That's correct.
At one of his companies.
Yes. And as I was informed tonight, I've never actually talked to Andrew before.
That's right.
Now,
before today.
Here's a little behind the scenes look at how we do a show. November is the month that our research team, our guest research team, is off for the holidays.
Right.
And you said that Andrew was an unschooler. So the picture, now, maybe it was a little bit of wishful thinking on my part, but what I imagined was that, and Andrew, don't take this the wrong way, I'm not in any way disappointed, we're going to have a fantastic time tonight, but what I pictured and what I prepared for was a man who was going to come in here, an adult, a successful adult, who you said is like really helpful to your business, to your operation, very good worker, generates ideas, independent, and he's never been to school.
this was okay. So I Andrew, even though I don't actually interact with Andrew very much,
sure,
at all, he has an older brother, Adam,
Yeah.
Who is another one of the all-stars of our company, Seikel CAI, which people may know. And these two guys are probably two of, if not the most, the best employees we've ever had. My particular style of running a company is it may be different than what people might imagine that someone who runs a company does, in that I don't really like telling people what to do.
Sure.
And I don't want people around who just want to follow directions and need to be told what to do all the time. Mm-hmm. Like, I want people who can ascertain problems, solve those problems, and implement the solution to those problems without me having to tell them how to do it.
Now, right? But with what consultation with superiors in the meantime? Because would you like it if somebody just, if the environment was, go solve this problem, let me know how it goes?
Yeah. So for example, Adam, Andrew's brother here, he's kind of my guy who does the things that I would normally do that I don't feel like doing.
Right.
He hasn't bothered talking to me for almost 2 months.
Okay.
Like I don't think I've talked to him once.
But how long has he worked for you?
A few years.
Okay. So then he's in a rhythm and he has an understanding and he does know you and there is some trust. So, I mean, this was a thing, like when last time I was looking for a job, maybe it was like 7 years ago and everyone was saying, put your self-starter on your resume, put self-starter. They're looking for self-starters.
And just a clue, everyone who says that they're a self-starter, is pretty much not.
Because they're they had to have somebody else tell them that they should put that on their resume.
Right. So it's the opposite of that.
Yeah. Like you should know that, but you do want somebody who is an autonomous problem solver. And then 5 years before that, when I was in college, they were saying, think outside of the box. Right. You got to think outside of that box. Everyone's thinking in the box right now. So self-starters thinking outside the box, but most people are not self-starters and are in a box. Right. And we talk about it on the show all the time, politically, with respect to education, the boxes that people are in that they refuse to acknowledge.
Right.
So boxes are very popular. It's a very boxy kind of world.
It is boxy. So back to the story of Adam and Andrew.
Sure.
So Andrew's brother, Adam, had, based on the conversations that we've had, he had built in my head this mythology that these two brothers had lived this life of not going to school.
Sure.
And he would say things to me like, oh, yeah, we never had to study any particular subject. We just studied whatever we felt like studying. And so my confirmation bias, knowing these two guys and how they function and that they have brains and can make decisions and do things quickly and awesomely.
Yeah.
I just assumed that meant that they had not been through school, because I don't know people who have gone through school that can behave this way. Right.
there's some truth to that. When I was in sixth grade, I got to pick whatever foreign language I wanted to try. And I started with Japanese, and I just went on, did that on my own.
You did it on your own?
Yeah, we just got a little booklet with a little cassette tape, and I just went to town on that. But
So we've talked about our school experience before. I went to 12 years of public school, count them 12, and then 4 years of undergrad at a mediocre college and 2 years of grad school at a slightly above mediocre college. Osborne, you were, you know, homeschooled for a while. You went to a traditional public high school, right? And then
I went to high school for 2 years.
Okay. And then you went through about 6 to 8 years of college, guessing?
Yeah, eight, nine.
Like, and wound up with a PhD. I wound up with completing a certificate program to be certified in secondary education, and I was like maybe 9 to 12 credits short of a master's when I left. You did go to school. So all of my show prep on the unschooling stuff, we'll just keep that page separate. But if you want, you can call 843-JOIN-SSP or Skype into School Sucks Live. If you have an unschooling success story or even questions about it, like, I'm still prepared to answer some questions. And we also were just talking during our pre-show tonight about how I'd like to get away from some of this language of unschooling and homeschooling. And I like home education, a term that I learned from Laurette Lynn. You said, Osborne, you like...
I like natural education, because I don't like the idea that people are just stuck in their homes.
Yeah.
Instead of actually engaging the world.
And the other thing that I like about natural education, which not enough people are saying, I think we should start using that on this show.
Yeah. Well, and it's the idea, this is how people learn every day. Like adults who aren't in school, that's how they learn. They want to learn something, they go learn it. That's natural, right?
Yeah, because learning is living. And for so long, we're taught to compartmentalize the two, right? Like school is not part of living, and school is where learning takes place. Mm. So they're like separate, and as far as their fun and enjoyment and the intrinsic motivation of hobbies and living versus learning, which happens in school, they're pretty much diametrically opposed as far as like one is coercive, one is forced, one is compulsory, and the other is chosen freely. And we know that when things are chosen freely by us, they're fun, they're exciting, they're satisfying. And when we're forced to do things, they suck. And we have a show here called School Sucks. Now, also, Andrew, you had no idea what you were walking into tonight.
That's
you don't
correct.
Even know what we're doing here.
No idea.
School Sucks sounds very negative, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That's what they tell me. Yeah. I thought it was a good, when I came up with the idea for a podcast, we only started doing this live show about 6 months ago, but did a podcast for many years, and I thought it was a good marketing package, you know? Because I had worked in education since the year 2000. And one thing that kids always told me is school sucks, you know? But it's not just like a slogan, like this reductive, dismissive slogan. School seems to take out of so many of us. When we're young, we're creative, we're imaginative, we're independent, we're optimistic. Look at most people by the time they're 18. And you know what? You said the schools you went to were different than most public high schools, right? Or most public school experiences. You did not have a traditional school experience in grades 1 through 8. You did go to a normal high school, albeit a small one. But can you tell us about the initial, your primary school experience? Because it sounded interesting.
Right. It was pretty much a one-on-one basis with a teacher. There was one other person in my class for the whole 8 years I was there.
Yeah.
We would get our curriculum once a year. You'd get a math book. You'd get a history book. You get your spelling book. You get all those things. And you just work through it at your pace, and if you got done in 3 weeks, then you were done with that level. I mean, if it took you the whole year, it took you the whole year, but typically it didn't take you that long.
Just curious, in your grammar textbooks, did you diagram sentences?
Yes, we did. Yeah, we had to diagram
another
sentences.
Thing you don't get in a public school.
Yep.
Now let's talk about that, because I'm sure somebody's listening who's unfamiliar with diagramming sentences. What is that?
Really? That's when you take a sentence and a particular method of pictorializing all the words from the sentence in such a way that you distinguish each word's...
Right. Whether they're nouns, adverbs,
place, purpose in the sentence.
One of my pet peeves has been vocabulary. And I find that a lot of high school students, myself included, and for those of you who might not know this, I was an SAT tutor for a long time. Still technically I am. I have one client right now. But vocabulary is not what it should be. And they always tell me these stories. Yeah, they give us a list of words. We look them up in the dictionary. And then we get a vocabulary quiz on Friday on those words. And then we basically dump them out of our memory. And 2 years later, when we see the word, we say, oh, that was a vocabulary word once. But they don't remember what it meant. So do you remember, like, in that period, how you were being taught vocabulary? Because I'm wondering if they were going at it more of like a root structure thing.
Yeah, it was basic root structure. Because I even remember in high school, once I moved to the public high school, we had spelling tests in high school that I remember taking in third grade that we did. I mean, it seems ridiculous, but that was the level they were on compared to where I was at that point.
Now, how did you do in a public high school spelling test?
Very, very well.
Can I test you on that?
I don't know if I'll remember now.
Okay.
But
I'm just going to pick words from, I have a list right here of standard public high school spelling bee words. Are you ready?
Yes.
Kitten.
Language of origin, please.
I don't even know. Okay. That's a joke, everyone. I don't have a spelling list. No, but I mean, spelling is less of a problem from what I've seen than vocabulary is. But to know the roots, to know the Greek and Latin origins of the English language, somebody can effectively, or like functionally, I guess, increase their vocabulary by thousands of words. Like knowing what auto means, knowing that it's not about cars is very helpful. right? So one of the things that kind of, it seemed like at the turn of the last century, the 20th century, from the 19th to the 20th century, that this look-say method of reading where they tried people to teach people reading by sight words. So you would just see a word and try to remember, almost like you would memorize aspects of a picture, right? So you see the beginning and the end, and you say, oh, I know that kitten has a K at the beginning and an N at the end. So then you see the word kindergarten, and you say, eh, kitten. So that was another common problem, is the way that people were being taught to read and taught to increase their vocabulary.
The same way they teach math. It's just all about memorizing formulas and concepts rather than teaching how to derive those concepts from first principles.
Sure. And thinking about math almost like magic. Right? Like the distance formula is not a magical spell that tells you the length of a line on an XY axis, right? If you've listened for a long time and you've heard these stories before, let's keep in mind Andrew is new, so we're trying to kind of run through the basics of what we do on the show here. There's nothing explained in a way that would be interesting, that would inspire somebody to want to investigate more, like, oh, that's really cool. There was a story that hit the news recently, and it had me thinking,
I love this story,
a lot about my career, where my career was going, and if I was, making the most of my time as far as what my goals are in education. And somebody sent this to me. I will thank the listener in the podcast because the name actually escapes me right now. But this was in bbc.co.uk, the BBC's website, and the title of the article is Meet the Tudor Kings and Queens by Johanna Sharma. I'm going to read it, and we're going to talk about it.
Do it.
They strike glamorous poses in posters in shopping malls and on the sides of buses. But they are not movie stars or supermodels. They are Hong Kong's A-list Tudor kings and Tudor queens, offering pupils a chance to improve mediocre grades. In Hong Kong's consumer culture, looks sell. Celebrity tutors in their sophisticated hairdos and designer trappings are treated like idols by their young fans who flock to their classes. And they have earnings to match. Some have become millionaires and appear regularly on television shows. If you want to be a top tutor, it definitely helps if you are young and attractive. Students look at your appearance, says Kelly Mock, 26, a tutor queen at King's Glory, one of Hong Kong's largest tutorial establishments. Her designer clothes and accessories are not just for the billboard. It's how she likes to dress outside classes. But she's also careful to add that she wouldn't be in such high demand if she could not deliver top grades in her subject, English. Well, after reading just this much, and I do a similar thing for work. Most of my tutoring has been for the SAT.
You wear designer clothes?
No, I do a similar thing for my vocation.
I got you.
I try, I'll iron before I go somewhere.
All right.
But as you see me tonight, like if you look at the people on the other side of the room, Andrew and Osborne, they look like two nice gentlemen who had dinner. And if you look at me, I look like somebody who's about to rob them.
had dinner in a dumpster.
Oh, my goodness. No, I'm not somebody who eats out of a dumpster, but definitely somebody who would rob people who ate in a restaurant. But right. No, I mean, like, I go to work without a hat on. I iron my shirt. I have nice sweaters that go with collared shirts. I actually had to wear this because of a wardrobe malfunction earlier tonight. I planned to wear a sweater and a collared shirt. The collar was all twisted on my shirt, and it would have been more foolish than what I have on right now. So appearance is very important. People do look at appearance. I understand that. But being treated like a rock star, I mean, I feel like how I normally get treated is like just another teacher. Even though in my mind, I feel like I want to offer them something so much different, but they just say, oh, here's another one of these people. I feel like I have to, that's something in my work that I have to overcome.
Right. Now, on the other hand, you do a show called School Sucks Live.
Right.
Which you're doing right now.
Yeah.
And when you go places where people know you from School Sucks Live, they treat you in this manner, much like a rock star.
More so than the kids that I do the SAT.
So why is that? What's the difference? You get on a microphone, you're a rock star, but you go to their house,
Okay.
And you're not.
Because it's too, I think that that's a really good question. And this is, after I read this article, these were the thoughts that I was having. Oftentimes, I feel like I'm just a reinforcer for a system, you know, and a mindset that these kids really don't like, that they're really not benefiting from. And I'm somebody who is making money off this extra pressure that kids feel and parents reinforce and maybe a lot of the times create for these kids.
Right. Well, I mean, are you reinforcer? Or are you helping them get through the morass that they've been placed in?
I am. I try to make that known. Mm-hmm. I try to be clear that I'm doing something different. I think it's so valuable sometimes to just hear an adult in the front of a so-called classroom say, you know, how you feel is right. A lot of this stuff is BS. A lot of these impositions are completely unnecessary. And, you know, you shouldn't feel ashamed to be reacting to them in what is a very natural way, you know? And I think for some kids, and I know that for a fact, just from some of the experiences that I've had, and I had one recently with a student at UNH, that it's just a relief to hear, yeah, you know, it might not be you. You're not defective. You might just, like, because you can't squeeze yourself into this mold that you're expected to squeeze yourself into, that's not really a problem with you. So, but this situation in Hong Kong, I think is, like, out of control, because there's so much pressure on these kids already, and these people are, I mean, yes, I'm benefiting from a similar type of system, but they're really raking it in, basically off parental and student anxiety.
Are they, or do they see that it's all BS? Because, I mean, they're hiring people based on how they look and dress,
right,
to do this job, right? So, I mean, to me, that looks more like, at least get me someone hot to do this for me.
I don't know, but it also shows what the obsession might be with so-called overachievement in, you know, Asian countries, which also comes with a very, very high teen suicide rate, you know, which is something but let's read on a little more and see what else we can discover. The next heading is rock star image. Richard Ng from Beacon College is often credited with being the first of Hong Kong's star tutors. A former secondary school teacher, he says he got the idea after he featured in photographs advertising his sister, a performance artist. In school, all the teachers look the same. There's no excitement, he said. His own image appears on special ring binders and folders containing study tips, or pens which harbor a pull-out scroll with his picture and other gifts. Such items became so sought after that they propelled him to near rock star status among young people.
But I like that they're correctly identifying this notion that, yay, this education system that we have lacks excitement.
Mm-hmm.
But the solution to bring in designer clothes is not the excitement the kids are looking for, I feel.
When Andrew's mics were muted, he said we should put schoolsucksproject.com on a t-shirt with John Stamos. It's his face.
It would sell.
Now, like, John Stamos sell. Now or, like, Uncle Jesse?
Oh, Uncle Jesse, definitely.
I don't know about that. I just saw John Stamos on a Glee episode.
Yeah.
And I think it's a season or two old. I was watching it on Netflix. But I don't know. I think he looks pretty hotter now than he did back.
Oh, he's very handsome now.
Yeah.
He was a creep then.
Yes. Yes.
Who has an Uncle Jesse living with them besides Bo and Luke Duke?
It is.
But anyway, there was
someone in the chat says school sucks plus Uncle Jesse equals winning.
See? It sells.
Yeah. So schoolsucksproject.com with a 1988 picture of the cast of Full House. The celebrity tutor phenomenon is a result of a huge growth of out-of-school tutoring in Asia. It is fueled by highly pressured examination systems and ambitious parents wanting their children to secure places at top universities and high-status secondary schools. In societies where success is equated with good exam results, parental anxiety converts into a steady stream of revenue for tutoring establishments, according to a study by the Asian Development Bank. The tutoring industry, or shadow education, as the ADB calls it, has become very widespread in Asia, fed by the growth in universities and the rising proportion of school leavers aiming for university. Hong Kong University professor Mark Bray, one of the authors of the ADB study, said a staggering 72% of final year students, school students in Hong Kong, now go to private tutors. Now, remember, everybody, this is not in lieu of school. This is in addition to school.
As if that's what they need is more school. Do you like that they use the words school leavers rather than graduates? Do you think that means anything?
No, I don't know.
Odd.
Now, what they're telling kids, I guess, in elementary school, when we talk about the pressure of higher education, the pressure to go, part of the scam of the whole thing that we've discussed before, somebody was saying, might have been a listener to this show who told me that their student, who I believe was in middle school, was told that their graduation year was whenever they were done with high school plus four. So if they were done with school in, let's say, 2017, done with, you know, secondary school, high school in 2017, they're given the graduation year of 2021, meaning that if they do not stay in school until 2021, they are a failure. So they're not graduating because they're either leaving middle school or leaving secondary school. And then, you know, when you think about all this pressure that's making all this money for these tutors, yes, the expectation is that you will go to more school. So yeah. You're not. So
isn't it hilarious that it's a precise number of years, like especially at the undergrad level, right, where there's all these different fields of studies that you can engage in.
Yeah.
They are all exactly 4 years, not 1 year more, not 1 year less. No matter what you are doing with your life, this is the number of years you must be schooled in your particular field.
Well, that's probably, they probably learned that from the high school, right? Because it takes every teenager exactly 180 days to make it through a Houghton Mifflin math book.
Right.
Right. What you were saying, Andrew, we talked about Andrew's school experience a little bit in the last hour. You were saying that you were, even though it was still a school where you did not have total independence and total control over your learning experience, you did have a lot more independence in primary and middle school than you would have had in high school. And
right.
You said, if you can make it through a book quickly, then you're
done. You could go on to the next years if you wanted, next year curriculum.
So anybody could work at their own pace.
Yep.
Yeah. I took a eighth grade girl through a algebra book in 2 months. So that was meeting once or twice a week. We were able to, like, just we could do a chapter in an hour and a half.
Yeah, well, we covered a story where they did a study with some number of kids, and they got through 12 years of school in a matter of a couple months by waiting until the kids wanted to do it.
Now, you said you did a study?
I didn't do the study. We read about it on the show.
Oh, that's right. We did.
Several weeks back.
I think Murray Rothbard even mentioned this in his book, For a New Liberty, in the education chapter. And I'll put a link to this in the show notes, and maybe I can even grab the audio, the Jeffrey Rickenbach audio of that book, where he talks about these training programs where, yeah, sure, like corporations love it when the taxpayers will fund the training of their employees, you know, in basic skills. But when they actually put people into these real job training situations, they could give them that every functional thing that school provided could be delivered in like a very finite amount of time compared to school, like 6 weeks tops. And Gatto, John Taylor Gatto, who we mentioned on the show all the time, has talked about, you know, it's 80 contact hours between a teacher and a student to teach reading and writing and basic math. So, but we're in public school for 15,000 hours. And as we've speculated, and as there's a lot of research to show, you know, school in this country was set up to make people, you know, 150 years ago, compliant factory workers and good citizens. And part of that is obedience. Part of that is conformity. You can't tell people that they're free and then not have them be all kinds of predictable. So school has certainly accomplished that. And that's not even you know, a conspiracy theory. It would be pretty foolish for them not to be that. We see the industry of public relations. We see all of the controls over the media. Yes, like there is a lot of thought and resources and time and energy and money that goes into shaping how the masses think. Because when you tell people they're free or you give them the illusion of freedom, it's very important that you can keep their thinking within a narrow and predictable range. Not a new subject for this show. Where were we? Richer families have always paid for individual tutoring, but But the star tutors offer exam tips and revision notes to the less well-off, studying in groups of over 100. That's a good idea. You can increase your numbers.
Price discrimination. You want to deliver as much product as you can to everyone for the price they are willing to pay.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, this was something that we did in my company. If we gave a price to a school and they said that's too high, and we weren't, let me be clear, we were not asking the school to pay for it. Like, this is what would be the cost. People could opt into the class and pay for it themselves. A lot of schools, like when I used to go, when I was very naive a few years ago, and I would go try to talk to guidance people and tell them about our service, like it was an actual business-to-business transaction and they would care what I had to say. You know?
No, that wasn't written into their budget 3 years ago when it was put in place.
No, but it's like, dude, it's the afternoon. This is when I have a yogurt and play Free Cell. I'm a guidance counselor. Come on. You know, so they would say, yeah, leave your leave whatever your materials are on that pile of that table with a pile of materials and maybe someone will look at it. So it was very hard to get into schools, but offering them lower rates that they could pitch to students was one way to do it. So I can recognize that right there. The next heading is getting an edge. It's not just Hong Kong. Tutoring has spread and intensified in Asia and become more commercialized, says Professor Bray. In South Korea, 90% of primary school children attend such classes. In South Korea, Thailand, Sri Lanka, and India, tutorial schools use star tutors to attract even more students. They have found a way to appeal to young people and pull them in. They create a buzz, he said. We had this phenomenon of star tutors in Kota as well, said Pramod Meshwari. I'm happy with that pronunciation, Meshwari.
That works for me. It's better than your German.
Chief executive of Career Point Coaching. It can give you an edge, but ultimately says the expansion of tutoring is driven not by personalities, but the inefficiency of the school system. Across India, students' education level is not up to the mark, and millions are preparing for competitive college examinations. This is a huge, it is a huge market, says Meshwari. In China, where private tutorial schools were unknown until the economy opened up in the 1990s, New Oriental Education and Technology has grown to become one of the largest tutoring schools in Asia with around 2.4 million students this year. It boasts 17,600 teachers in 49 cities and an online network of over 7.8 million users. Listed on the New York Stock Exchange since 2006, its founder, Michael Yu, became a multimillionaire on the back of his blend of rote learning exercises, stand-up comedy, and motivational speeches. That's quite the tricky combination.
Yeah, this is horrifying to me.
Why is that? I mean, yes.
Of course. I mean, it takes the horrible methods of so-called education that they use in school, and they are basically adding candy to it to make it go down easier, rather than fixing the problem by providing education in an appropriate manner.
Absolutely. A man from a humble background who had become an English teacher at Peking University, Mr. Yu, used the Hong Kong model of employing star tutors to prepare students for tests for universities abroad. Extensive tutoring is sometimes seen as contributing to East Asian countries' high performance in international school comparisons, particularly in mathematics. But Professor Bray points out that the high performers in the international PISA test Program for International Student Assessment also include countries that do not use much tutoring, such as Scandinavia. Next heading, tutor ban. There have also been attempts to reduce the impact of tuition, which is a, you know, word for tutoring.
Interesting.
Yeah, we usually think about that as the money we pay.
Yeah, I didn't understand what they were saying there.
Yeah. In the 1980s, the South Korean government issued a blanket prohibition on such private tutoring. It proved to be unenforceable, but it reflected worries that tuition can put too much pressure on pupils, with teachers complaining that pupils were falling asleep in class after long nights of tutoring.
Yeah, so it's the people trying to solve the problem of the pressure being put on the students that are labeled as the cause of it.
Well, right? I think, are they really trying to solve the problem, or are they just trying to cash in on all of this pressure that is considered to be acceptable?
Yeah, either whichever one it is, they're doing both, right?
Well, I don't. Yeah,
I mean, it's like the attorney who helps you when the government's coming after you, right? I mean, yes, he's cashing in on the fact that the government is coming after you, but he's helping you out of this problem that you've got.
That is true. That is a good point. So they last paragraph we read, it proved to be unenforceable, and teachers were complaining that students were falling asleep after long nights of these extra tutoring classes. So we're talking like 10, 12 hours of school in a day.
I mean, they give you homework, right? Like, they keep you in school for 8 hours, and then they give you homework. Like, you're supposed to do more.
Yeah.
Like, normal people only work 8 hours a day, right?
Yeah.
But no, kids are supposed to do, well, no, you're supposed to do 12, 14 hours of your work.
Yeah, I would say that the average American overachiever probably has 10 hours of work, 10 hours of committed time a day between school and homework. And that doesn't even count extracurriculars. Because they're supposed to be in, you know, play the flute and lacrosse too,
right?
So
and be in, yeah, National Honor Society and whatever.
Yeah,
what do you call those things where you like pick up trash and put food in homeless people? I don't know.
The Illuminati.
Yeah.
But volunteering.
Yeah, sure.
Well, yeah, and a lot of other schools have like to have this sense of civic duty. They have mandatory volunteering.
Right.
Yeah.
Just like, yeah.
So to get kids excited about volunteering, they force them to do it, which is why everyone in this country is so smart and so fit because of all the force, right? Forced to do gym, forced to do math. Look at the results. It's beautiful. In 2009, the South Korean government adopted measures to limit the number of hours students spent in hangwons, or tutorial centers, in a bid to reduce childhood stress and increase the level of creative thinking. But the impact has been limited, pushing many tutorial classes online. The government has since realized that the only way to change is to alter the exam culture, reducing the number of university entrance exams and encouraging universities to consider applicants on more than just exam scores. A Singaporean study showed that while tutoring can have a positive influence on the subject being tutored, time taken away from other subjects may lead to a discipline in overall academic importance. And this is so true. I mean, especially in areas where students might be more interested and they might have more intrinsic personal motivation to do something, that time is stolen from them and has to go into an area where they have no interest.
Right. And God forbid they take the next logical step and just get the kids out of the schools.
Yeah, I mean,
completely.
When somebody first sent this to me, I got really excited about it because you hear about these tutors becoming stars. And then immediately, so I think there was this extra disappointment for me when I found out what this article really was about. Because I thought about it in, like, tutoring is a good word, how I think about it, based on how I feel about what I do most of the time. So I say, oh, this is great, where all of this pressure exists in these countries, right? Where there's just so much pressure put on these kids to perform in these schools. They have this alternative to that. And it wasn't that at all. It was just reinforcement. I am happy to hear that there has been some effort on the part of government officials of all people to at least go through the motions of trying to reduce student stress. An ADB report says in all parts of Asia, families are spending a considerable amount of household income on tutoring. It may contribute to improved achievement for individual students, but it can exacerbate social inequalities. Next heading, exam panic. Although there is some evidence of a cultural propensity to pay for tutoring, cities such as Vancouver in Canada and Sydney in Australia, with large Chinese communities, have a lot of tutoring. This is not the only factor. What happens in tutoring depends on what the schools and universities ask for. The parents will respond to whatever they think will get them in, says Professor Bray. Hong Kong recently shifted from a system similar to GCSEs and A-levels used in the UK to a single examination taken at age 17, leading to an explosion in tutoring. There is greater pressure on students because there is only one examination that determines whether you get into university, said Kelly Mock. With so many tutors in Hong Kong, students don't know who to choose, so they go for the tutor kings and the tutor queens, she says. Some students just attend the lectures and watch video recordings of lectures, while others purchase add-ons such as personalized interaction with the star tutor or tutor's aid via Facebook or email. Tutor's aid must be nice. But as more students enroll, it can become increasingly difficult to keep up with examination tips learned by classmates. Oh, you're kidding. Students who would not otherwise have had tutoring may now do so in order not to be at a competitive disadvantage, says Professor Bray. But Richard Eng denies that tutors are sowing panic. Panic comes from the exams themselves. If there was no examination in Hong Kong, no matter what I say or look like, they would not come to me.
And that's my point.
Yeah, and he's absolutely correct in that respect. But, you know, obviously don't want to demonize these tutors for capitalizing on this. And in a consumer culture, the high pressure of performance and education in this culture, this kind of thing, this is the logical consequence of those other factors. But, gosh, you know, I feel after reading this and after thinking about some things that have happened to me, I feel like even here I am contributing to this problem. And during the break, we were talking a little bit about weighing what I do professionally versus what we're trying to do on this podcast and at School Sucks Project.
I wouldn't want to do what you do. Just because, I mean, I got out of that business, right?
Yeah.
Because I don't think you can help people once they get to that age.
But here, we can have a more targeted audience, right? The people who will download and listen to this podcast are pretty hot leads compared to people who are just wander into an SAT class.
That I agree.
And immediately categorize me as somebody else. So why am I not putting these resources into this, which has been much more successful, not monetarily, but in that other respect?
Yeah, in terms of helping people, yeah.
And I think that the podcast is the basket that my eggs should probably be in.